Welcome to We Empower, the radio show that inspires you to embrace your potential, resilience, and strength. In these challenging times, we're here to help you unlock your power to overcome obstacles, pursue your dreams, and shape a brighter future. I'm Anna Bertanes, your host for this empowering hour. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of We Empower. I'm thrilled to have you all with us today. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Let's make today count. In today's episode, we will have a great guest here to introduce. As first of all, Aliyah Roser, from Secret Service to Global Women's Empowerment. Aliyah Roser on courage, identity, healing, and reclaiming power after life in the shadows. And then first, we talked to Jojo Mehta, as an environmental justice leader and co-founder of Stop Ecocid, working to establish Ecocid as an international crime and reorient law around the protection of the earth. She bridges legal innovation, diplomacy, and public storytelling to turn a once radical idea into a serious global conversation. But first, let us kick on the start of the radio show with a song selected by Jojo. Welcome, Jojo Mehta. Welcome here from expert graduate Ecocid Trailblazer. You are rewriting the rules of justice so mass damage to nature becomes a crime and hope becomes policy. Welcome here in the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
I would like to introduce you with a few words, Jojo. You stand up at the point where law, imagination, and planetary survival meet. You co-founded Stop Ecocide in 2017 together with a late barrister and legal pioneer, Polly Higgins, to pursue a simple but revolutionary idea that mass damage and destruction of ecosystems should be recognized as a crime at the highest level of international law. As CEO and key spokesperson of the global Stop Ecocide movement, you now navigate between legal experts, diplomats, business leaders, and activists, weaving them into a common story of responsibility and repair. Under your guidance, an independent expert panel chaired by Philip Sands and Dayar Fall so draft a legal definition of ecocide that was launched in 2021 and is already inspiring legislative proposals and resolutions around the world, thank God, with teams and representatives and dozens of countries. You spend your days turning outrage into strategy and fear into focused action, from your conferences halls to grassroots circles. With a background in communications, entrepreneurship, and hands-on environmental campaigning, you bring not only sharp legal messaging, but also practical hacks for staying grounded, hopeful, and effective in the face of planetary crisis. Welcome here.
Thank you so much.
In these days, I think, or I can, f I would feel with you if we say there are some days also where it is a bit more gray than other days, and it is sometimes maybe hard to bring colors into this world. Is this true?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, literally, right now in the world, we are looking at a situation where, there are some large players who are treating international law with disdain, really. But what I would certainly perhaps kick off by saying is that we see this not as the, if you like, the failure of international law, but rather the presence of certain large players who are ignoring that law. And actually, for most of the world, there's an acute consciousness that we really do need international law and multilateralism. It's, if anything, becoming acutely more, sort of present in people's consciousness.
We haven't talked about that. This is the first question I address to you. But as you said, and I think the time is important, it's more important than ever to talk about these things. Would you say, and some people say so, that this is a kind of time where we just figure out that these people are there, and we just look at them, and we just bring it to the public, and it was always that the case? Or would you say it has gotten worse?
No, I mean, I think that what we've seen over the last few decades is the result of something that goes back far deeper and far further. It goes back to the sort of origins of what is now our global economic system, which is based on a kind of a separation between people and nature. There's the whole of our economic system has grown up around a kind of exploitative mindset of, nature is there as a bank of resources for us. And we can, treat her as we please, in order to fulfill our societal needs, requirements, and often not even requirements, just what we happen to want to have. And I think in recent decades, the scale on which we've been able to do that has meant that the living world that completely sustains us has been increasingly in danger. And I think there is also, at the same time, and I think this is something you're hinting at, there has also been an awakening, I think, in ordinary people, as to the fact that this cannot continue, that we actually must reestablish a balance, where we can. Obviously, we require resources from nature to exist as a society, but what we've lost is that sense of equilibrium. There seems to have been a kind of unbridled exploitation that is just partly facilitated by our ability to do that technically.
A lot of people say, and of course it's easy to say so, that digitization is a key, and digitization is taking us away from our nature, because it's bringing us into the situation, as we just could also see with Crans-Montana, that people think that there's always somebody else who's taking care of us, and there's always somebody else who take responsibility, and don't have this intuition anymore to feel, oh, there is danger. I have to take care of myself. I have to take care of others. Would you say this is true? And digitization might be the key, or is the key, which has us been fallen into this, but might be also the key which can help us getting out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely it feels like a double-edged sword, doesn't it? It feels like, you know, that with the growth of AI, we could be, you know, we could be looking at, you know, mass loss of jobs, mass kind of abdication of responsibility. But at the same time, there's the possibility to actually be harmonizing what, you know, our activities in the world with what is both what is legal and what is safe. And that can, you know, there are ways in which digitization can assist with that. And I think there's also that, you know, digitization is moving so fast that I think right now we find ourselves in this quite scary moment of being almost sort of doubling down on the extractive mentality, where we've got the, you know, we've got renewables, you know, coming online and obviously, you know, becoming increasingly viable and all of those things, which ultimately will probably be a good thing. But at the same time, we're not stopping with the old forms of extraction. You know, there's this kind of rather very dangerous feeling kind of coincidence, and with the rise of AI and of course the huge energy requirements of all of that, you know, that's kind of in a sense, you know, adding insult to injury. However, I mean, some of the people we've been working with in that space, in the AI space, you know, are very clear with us that within a very few years, what is now taking huge amounts of energy will take a tiny fraction of that energy because the developments are moving so fast. So, you know, we can hope that we get through this sort of, you know, dark night of the extraction and technology and actually emerge into a space where it's less the case. But that's also where legal parameters like ecocide law are very important, because they set those sort of boundaries around what is actually acceptable to do and help us to steer whatever comes next. I mean, you know, I think it's very difficult for us to predict what the world will look like in 15 to 20 years time. But what we feel very strongly, and I think is really resonating now in the world, is that however that emerges, we must have some basic frameworks in place that prevent us from, I suppose, sawing off the branch we're sitting on.
Absolutely. And I like also what you said. I mean, we have the old weapons, we have the old instruments, and with this, we try to face the now and the future. Why is that? Why don't we get along with new laws, with new restrictions, which are saving the nature better, which are giving us more ideas on how to save the planet by not losing the future?
I mean, I would actually slightly take issue with the why not, because actually, in our line of work, it's interesting to see how fast things are actually moving. I mean, you know, when my dear co-founder and friend and Polly Higgins passed away in 2019, at that time there were no governments talking about these laws to protect from ecocide. Now we're just sort of six and a half years on, and we're now seeing proposals all over the world in national jurisdictions. Well over 20 nations have proposed laws of ecocide. There are regional agreements. The EU has put a directive in place that requires all the EU states to harmonize with, to protect against some conduct comparable to ecocide. There's also been an actual proposal at the International Criminal Court to add ecocide to the list of international crimes. So to go from a obscurity to what is clearly a kind of inevitable direction of travel in that short space of time is really quite remarkable. And I think it speaks to that growing awareness that something concrete must be put in place, because, you know, there are, of course, you know, the COP talks, you know, the climate discussions, and there are, you know, there's plenty of sort of environmental regulation in place, but having something with teeth, and something that speaks to the moral aspect, which is what criminal law does. You know, it talks to how, you know, what we feel is right and wrong, what we feel is acceptable and not acceptable. So to go into that field with a law that prevents the worst harms is becoming ever more important. And it's becoming, I think, ever more understood how important that is. And I think that's why we're seeing a sort of snowballing of progress around this initiative.
I like that very much what you said, but also taking in place that it looks like that, having said, old instruments are taken again for a new world, just as Trump's actions on Venezuela, his ideas on Greenland. This isn't this something, or what are your ideas on something like this? How can we stop something like this? Because it's an old thinking. It's a very old thinking, which comes again. It shows it shows also the situation that United Nations, that also other big country organizations, communities don't know how to act now, to act there, because it's a new situation. It has never been done something like this. So I mean, it is what is necessary now. What can be done? Because we don't have with the United Nations these instruments which can judge somebody like this in a way that he's doing more than just laughing or putting higher his eyebrows.
That's really, I mean, that's a really, pokey question, shall we say. And I think what we're looking at the moment is a space where actually the world is reeling on one level and looking at, what can be done, what conversations need to be had. It's still very new. I mean, really very new. We're talking in the last sort of week and a half. The rest of the world is definitely kind of, I think, trying, to sort of take stock and think, well, what actually can we do here? And I think that there's also, I'm actually going to dig a little bit deeper, if it's okay, into the kind of emotional background of what is it, what is happening here, because there is, there is such, we've seen sort of, a rise of nationalism. We're seeing, a rise of kind of, the idea that, a big power can do what it wants and so on. And these are attitudes that come out of fear. They're attitudes that come out of ultimately, that same mindset that I described a short while ago, that mindset of sort of separation and not understanding that we are all interlinked with each other. I mean, the global economic system, which keeps all of us going day to day, is so intertwined that, when something like this arises and everything starts to look sort of in question, it actually may well be that economic network and weaving that becomes part of the counterpoint to that. But I think that, sort of underneath that, we also need to look at this emotional aspect. And this is something that also brings in what you mentioned briefly, Indigenous, earlier, which is that we speak with the Indigenous cultures a lot. And something that we see in the West, in the sort of first world developed countries, if you like, is a real lack of belonging. So people don't, on the whole, feel at home, either often not in themselves and often not in their land. And when you and when I say land, I don't mean political nations. I mean literally landscapes. When I moved back to my hometown, which I did in I think 2011, having lived in London, lived in Rome, lived in Paris, lived in these big metropolises, moving back to a rural area where I grew up, within a few weeks, I had this extraordinary sense of feeling like I was returning to the land where I belonged. And I say it that way round. We, in our economic approach, we tend to think we own land. We tend to think that land belongs to us. But when you speak with Indigenous cultures, there's this profound understanding that actually we belong to land and we are part of land. Now, if we don't feel at home in the land, if we don't feel at home in ourselves, of course we become defensive, we become protective. We think we have to somehow stake out our home by saying these are our national boundaries, or these are our personal boundaries, or that person over there is other and we don't trust them. When you talk to somebody that's at home in themselves, they're not defensive, they're not aggressive, they don't need to be. They feel completely all right with who they are. And our sort of global culture that has gone with this sort of this economy, this philosophy, this culture, this attitude of separation, we've lost that connection. And I do wonder, I mean, it feels like this is some way from where your original question was, but I do wonder whether if this is something that we can address at a level of culture, at a level of consciousness, and ultimately at a level of states, we can start to shift our understanding in some way. And sometimes having these rogue players who are behaving so badly, you know, I mean, this is not to say that, you know, I don't know, Venezuela was a happy place before this happened. But that's not the point. You can't just go in and, like, you know, kidnap a head of state. This is, you know, these are extraordinary breaches of a multilateral understanding. And what we also have to, I think, remember is that, you know, the sovereign state is still the kind of highest political entity in the world. Any multilateral organization is there by grace of sovereign states agreeing for it to be there. So, you know, if those sovereign states can begin to, you know, understand something of what is kind of happening culturally in this moment, we can actually see some of those players as catalysts for having us really rethink how we behave with each other, both as, you know, as people, as countries, you know, but also politically.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jojo. We will talk further about this, because also about the link to the indigenous people, because this might be also a part of a piece of the solution, a puzzle piece of the solution. We hear each other again, and stay tuned in approximately 2 minutes. Thank you.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Jojo, we just talked about what can be done and which situations are we currently, what happened and why is the situation like it is. And we talked also about indigenous people, how they feel. And you just also mentioned a sentence, which I would like to repeat, that that the country, that the people belong to a country. So it's a country which is not the political country, not the political state, but the country itself, the ground, the earth, the piece of a planet, which is calling the people, which gives the people the idea that they are home. And I completely understand you. I was a few days ago, first time in my life in Romania, because my grandmother, during her life, she said, And we have roots in Romania and Canada and France. And she said, Anwar, I won't die until you've been with me in Canada and Romania. In Romania, she was born and grew up. And I never went with her because I hope that she stays longer alive. And every year she said, Anwar, let's go to Canada and Romania because I'm getting weaker. I said, you have to stay alive. I won't get there. I won't go with you. And now this year, it was time she died. She passed away. And so I went to Romania and I just come from Romania. And it was really, as you described, I put a foot onto the Romanian ground and I was like, oh my God. It filled my whole body with joy and with thankfulness. And even I didn't land in Constanza where she was born and grew up, but it felt so deep as home. And it was, all people were so nice to me and friendly and put their arms around me and said, oh, can I greet you? Can I hug you? And it was a kind of truly coming home experience. And in Germany, where I was born and grew up, I've never felt this at no place. And with my culture, with my expression of warmth and positive and open-minded and seeing the glass always half full and not half empty or close or full, it is a completely different mentality. So, I mean, it's interesting if we are talking to indigenous people, which are providing us a lot of philosophy, a lot of truth from there as they are, without being scientists, without maybe even having read one book, and saying that, for example, I said to them a while ago, why aren't you writing down your secrets, the secrets of herbs, of how can you see better, Farah, how can you hear better, all these secrets, why don't you write this down? And they said, no, we are different. This is a communication. This is a collaboration. This is a people to people. There is no machine in between. There is no paper in between, no instruments. It's very pure, and that's what we are. If this dies, the knowledge, the deep knowledge of us will die, but we won't write it down. And they said another sentence. They said the people started to eat animals instead of having them as pets and treating them on eye level. This is a start of damaging our own life with the animals. You treat the animals like this, you treat other peoples like this. If you don't change this, then you are attacking yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, I mean, this is fascinating. I mean, we work a lot with Indigenous spokespeople who relate very strongly to the work that we're doing around ecocide law. And I actually think it's because there's a kind of almost a DNA level understanding of a kind of, a reciprocity between humanity and the earth. And there's a sort of fundamental understanding that when we damage Mother Earth, there are consequences. You know, that's a fact. And for the indigenous cultures, that isn't, it's not just a physical fact, it's also a spiritual fact. And so reflecting that in the legal frameworks feels very intuitive and natural to them. And certainly when you look at, I mean, actually, I've yet to meet, an indigenous representative that didn't eat meat, but the relationship between the culture and that, what is eaten, what is hunted, what is, is totally different. You know, it's absolutely personal. It's absolutely respectful. There's a whole, almost a sort of a dance there that exists between humanity and between the both prey animals, but also the living world, the living environment. And there is a direct communication between people and between and plants and animals and the spirits of those plants and animals. And it's interesting also that when we look at the sort of very edges, the cutting edges of science, what we're now finding is that there are very fertile queries around consciousness in the universe, you know, and what kinds of consciousness there are, whether actually, you know, consciousness is even included as part of the sort of building blocks of what creates our reality. And I think that brings us to another aspect that also ties in with Indigenous perspectives and cosmologies, which is that we have a reciprocal input into the reality in which we live. And when we think about it, this is actually, funnily enough, it's not rocket science, in the sense that the world that we live in now is the direct result of the intents and actions of those who came before us. So sometimes when people say to me, you know, is it realistic to expect that this law will come into place? And I'm like, well, what do you mean by realistic? You know, are you saying that, you know, the reality that we live in is one that we've ultimately created, or those before us have created? So I feel like I'm being completely realistic. I'm saying, well, this law will be in place and it will actually create a healthy framework for us. Because if we don't say that, well, how will it? You know, we actually have to be actively engaged in creating our own realities. You know, collectively, that is purely physically, factually, scientifically, politically, that is what we do. We create the reality we are going to be living in.
I like that what you said, and I think more people should realize this, that with every step you do, you're creating reality, if you want or not. And what you said with Indigenous, maybe so one small point, I think we here in the Western world, we often think and black and white. So eating meat, no eating meat. Being dressed like this, not being dressed like this. But that there are gray zones, or that there is a living with the nature, means also having a kind of circle in understanding that we can eat plants or meat without hating animals or treating them in a bad way. We can eat plants without treating them in a way that we don't respect them. But the Indigenous won't change them. They won't manipulate them. They won't gene manipulate them. They wouldn't try to give them another identity. And I think this is the difference. We sometimes think, or the Western world sometimes have thought, that they can play God. And we see it also now with the ideas to live on Mars, to live on Moon, and the high expectations, or live under the earth, for example, where in United States, at a secret place, flats which are 16th or 20th floor under the earth, were sold out in a few minutes because they promised how to live after atomic attack on Earth.
So I mean, I find this extraordinary. I mean, do we actually want to live in a planet like that? I would rather, you know, remain connected to the living world and die with it if that actually happens. You know, I don't want to be living in some bunker, you know, sort of many meters underground. I don't want to be living on the moon. I don't want to be living on Mars. I mean, I don't have anything against, you know, in effect, in principle, space exploration. But, you know, there's plenty to be looking at here at home in terms of the harmony of how we can actually coexist with the world that sustains us. I mean, you know, we live in this extraordinary sort of paradise of a planet, you know, and you know, we're busy kind of, whatever it said in that song, was it paving over paradise and putting a parking lot, you know, we're still busy doing that. And yet at the same time, there is so much research to show that even just the smallest time spent in nature, the smallest connection with nature, growing a plant yourself, all of these things, you know, have a totally disproportionate effect on our well-being. And I mean, one of the things that I do, I mean, you know, what the work that we do is working a lot with, you know, it's working with diplomats, working with business people, working with faith leaders, academics, so many different, you know, areas. And also, of course, working with this whole sense that, you know, the natural world is being destroyed. And, you know, sometimes people say to me, well, you know, how do you stay centered in that context? And one of the things that I do every single day is I go out in the garden with my bare feet, even if it's snowing. I mean, obviously, I don't stay out there very long if it's snowing because I get too cold, but my feet get too cold. But the fact is, it's about connecting with the ground. And actually, and you know, and that kind of reminds me, this is what it's about. It's actually about relationship with everything that's sustaining me, that's sustaining all of us. And actually, literally that physical connection, you know, is now scientifically proven to have a stabilizing effect on the body. But, you know, for me, it's not about that sort of, you know, scientific side. It's about that connection. It's about really feeling, again, you know, reminding myself that this is where I am at home.
Absolutely. It's the small, easy things which gives us that. And it reminds me, and I want to share this with you. I spent at a friend's retreat, which calls Within. It is in Poland. I spent there 4 days under earth in an apartment without light, without wireless LAN, without people, just me. And it was a one room apartment with a yoga mat and a bed and of course shower and so a place to eat once a day. I got via a small box. I got the food and the drinks, and I was alone with me. And before, I was not sure what it makes with me because I have a trauma from an abuse in the dark. And but the door opened, and it's in a complete rural area with trees around, wide view, animals around, and I was in this dark, and it was such being with a friend. It was that this easiness, this pureness made me so thankful being with myself. And exactly that, what you said, all of these things were around me, phone calls, emails, animal, you have to be there, animal, go there. A lot of atmosphere, frequencies, energies, which makes me feeling like this. Nothing, empty. It was so good. I came out and I thought that I'm more resilient, but I wasn't. I was more wounded for things because it made me open, understanding more how much overload I had before. And because I lost the understanding, I lost the feeling, I lost the intuition for how much overload I took over. Mm. And the first thing was that I said, oh my God, before it was all easier, now it's all harder, but exactly what we need.
It's interesting. This reminds me of something, because I think if you're in a sort of a space where you're making change, and you're kind of being very active in the world, particularly politically, or if you're visible and so on, what you find is that people often come up to you and say, oh, you should do this. You know, have you thought about doing that? It's almost like because you're the kind of person that is doing that, that somehow you end up with being responsible for what everybody wants to happen. And Polly had a brilliant way of dealing with that. When people came up to her and sort of said, oh, you know, you should do this, or have you thought about that? She would simply deflect it back to them in the most beautiful way. And she would say, that's a wonderful idea. That's absolutely what you should do. And she, you know, effectively encouraging people to actually, when they have those inspirations or those moments where they feel that something needs to be done, there's nothing to stop them actually engaging in that. I think we're often conditioned to feel that we can't take action, that somebody, you know, that we have to therefore kind of approach the people that do take action. And sometimes people say to me, you know, Jojo, how do I be an activist? And I always think, well, there are kind of two things. Like, the first thing is identify the thing that really upsets you, the thing that where you feel a real sense of injustice, because that's the area where you're going to want to work, because there's something you want to do or some change you want to see. But and it's often the thing that makes you really angry. But if you stay in that anger, you can easily burn out. And so the second thing I always hope is to encourage people to connect to what it is that they really love doing, that they're really good at, that they do effortlessly. And sometimes they don't even know what that is. Their family or their friends might need to point it out to them. But if you can identify what is the thing you love doing, and just have some thinking, some strategic thinking around, how do I apply this to the thing that upsets me? And then you've got a recipe for really making change. And yeah, I mean, for me, it was always about communication. I was, you know, I was always really good at understanding why one person wasn't understanding another person. So how to kind of, in a sense, translate ideas. And that's ended up being absolutely what I do all day. But I think it's that thing, it's that finding that combination. What upsets you and what do you love doing? Put those together and you've got a recipe for action in the world.
Thank you so much. That's the best word for ending this, wherever I would like to, if you could extend that. And Jojo, I hope to see you very soon. I'm looking forward to doing together with you things to change the world for the better. Thank you so much for the work you do.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So we have a small break of 2 minutes, and then I'm looking forward to having Alia here in the show.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
From Secret Service to Global Women's Empowerment, Alia Rosar on Courage, Identity, Healing, and Reclaiming Power After Life in the Shadows. Welcome, Alia Rosar.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning, everyone.
I would like to introduce Alia with a few words. Some stories are not meant to impress, they are meant to awaken. Today's guest is you, a woman who has lived many lives, crossed invisible borders and transformed danger into purpose. Born into a high-ranking military family in the former Soviet Union, trained within the secret services, Alia, you once operated in worlds defined by silence, risk, and survival. After completing your final mission, you disappeared, literally. Witness protection, a new name, a new continent, and eventually a new calling. Today, you are a globally recognized women's empowerment coach, speaker at the United Nations, journalist for Love Official Monaco, podcast host, best-selling audiobook author, and humanitarian leader. With over 1 million followers, you speak not from theory, but from lived experience about resilience, identity, sexuality, self-worth, and the courage to begin again. This is not a conversation about reinvention as a trend. This is a conversation about truth, inner strength, and the quiet power of choosing yourself, even after darkness. Thank you and welcome, Alia.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I mean, we are talking about the time where we talked about USSR, right? Where you were born. Just give me, allow me to ask you one question. What is the most important memory or also strength from this time, from your childhood in your, let's say, military family?
Well, I was born in USSR, the country which doesn't exist anymore. And I was born in that country, which is, the pure totalitarianism, dictatorship, and Soviet Union, right, communism. And then when I was about 7 years old, I witnessed the fall of United Communist Country. And when all this country got separated, I've witnessed so many people lost their houses, so many homeless children, and my dad that time, who was high-ranking officer, a real patriot, inspired me and trained me to become a future agent. That time I didn't know exactly what it was, but When I entered the military school, I wouldn't say that it was a really amazing experience, but for sure, it was a very important school which gave me a lot of knowledges and techniques which I use on a daily basis. And I do believe that we need to teach our young generation and plant the seeds how to protect each other, how to help each other, how to help the planet, how to save our planet. And I really enjoyed the conversation with Giorgio, which you just had. And I totally agree with her that it's all about us being connected to each other, being connected to the universe, to the planet, with plants and animals. But the most important is to educate our children, because education is all about coping, and we're both parents. And this is what I teach my son, and that's what, when I teach my son, I teach also his friends who are also kids, and then go ahead and they teach someone else. And that's how does it work. Our life is lesson for the young generation, and that's important for us to give the right role model education.
Absolutely. I'm so with you, Alia. And I mean, you're an example for doing this par excellence. I mean, in your how you grew up, fear, braveness, but also the call for freedom were neighbors. Do you want to describe maybe how your connection was, how you get out of the one world, but how you trained also your resilience in an environment like this?
Yes, absolutely. I would love that. It was a really long journey to be able to speak openly about my past. It took me 20 years, and I used to live in Europe in many different countries, like in the UK for 6 years, in Switzerland, in France, in Italy, in Greece. So I've been traveling the world, hiding myself, changing identities, also being single mom with a little son. His father was killed when he was 1 year old. So I was scared. I hided ourselves, like my son as well. So we constantly were changing our houses, and it was really difficult. But you see, the thing is, as I said, like, education is the most important, and my education gave me this resilience and that power. As I said, yes, military spy school wasn't that great experience because I literally had to go through a lot of trauma. Like, I was raped, I was sexually abused, I was sent to the war. That time it was Chechen War. I had to go to a very dangerous, deadly missions. And eventually, at the last mission, the operation was called Vladimir. So it was my latest target, the drug dealer, the drug leader of the criminal gang who actually was bringing to Russia from Afghanistan a huge amount of heroin. Eventually, he was killed, and I had to get out. And like, it was really dark time in my life, but what I found, like, where I found my power, where I found the motivation to go to help others, because it's also healing myself when I, educate my women in my members club, when I speak openly in the public speaking about those techniques which help me. I do believe that in the darkest time, we need someone like a mentor or a guide who've been through a lot of things in the life, who can actually be there and say, "Listen, I'm here for you. I got you. It's really hard, I know, but you're not alone." And that's what I try to bring to my community, to people, to everybody who knows me, to speak openly in social media and everywhere, because people need to unite. This is also what you discussed before. It's so important to unite right now. We need these tribes, like we used to live in the ancient time, right? We had these tribes and so on. So now people are divided, but they divided for a reason, because the number one rule of the control is to divide and control. So that's why different governments of, like, different leadership of different countries literally divide people. And of course, we have, like, all these ongoing wars nonstop. So people still fight between each other, and we have all these difficulties and problems with nationalism and racism, which actually it's so silly to have right now at 21st century. We literally all mixed up already in this planet, so this is so silly, but people don't get it. And we need to unite right now, and that's why I share my techniques which I studied, and they're actually classified techniques. There is a reason why these techniques in the spy school were classified and not available for public, because once you learn it, you can see and you can spot any sort of manipulation everywhere, not just in your relationship and romantic, business, family relationship, but everywhere in media, news, around the world, what's happening. So this is what I try to share and educate people as well, so they can see through manipulation, they can see and understand what's going on, and then they can unite and help each other. So that's my mission for now.
Do you want to share maybe one tip with us?
Of course, the most important understanding how to prevent manipulation, how to see through and understand who is what's real intentions of like people around you is when somebody tries to push you to make a decision, when they calling you or texting you and telling you, especially in the business, like, come on, come on, do it now. For example, the stock market is so hot today. You have to do it now. Buy it now, buy it now. For example, in love relationship, when somebody love bombing you, telling you so many compliments and like also pushing you to do some decisions, and then they just disappear and then they come again, and you become so frustrated and you're completely unbalanced emotionally because this person manipulates you, and this is like really dark psychology where they give you a lot of rewards, right? A lot of treats, and then they just ignore you and then they come back. So this is emotional swings, and people should also see that in news and media, for example, when they say, oh, this guy is bad person, he did this and this, for example, Epstein files, right? I don't want to get really into that topic, but I just want to clarify that everything you see in the news, everything you read in the newspapers or so on, always ask who has benefit from this situation. Make your own research. We have ChatGPTs and internet globally. Go and check facts yourself, educate yourself, do your own research, and then make your own decision. You see, governments, they don't want us to make decisions because when we don't have our own opinion, it's easier to manipulate us. It's easier to push us to go and fight between each other. If we all would unite together, nobody would actually be able, I mean, I'm talking about leaders right now, make wars. They literally cannot like push these nations between against each other. It would be impossible. Like that's what we see in Ukraine and Russia, unfortunately. This is the same culture. These people live together for so many centuries. It's literally like, how many families have kids? One, the mother from Russia, the father from Ukraine, and yet like they fight between each other. But this is the biggest manipulation, and unfortunately, people don't see it. And that's the most important why we need to unite.
Exactly. I'm so with you. We have to unite globally and we have to unite in ourselves again. I'm looking from psychology side into leadership. And I mean, sometimes in the past where I haven't went into this, I ask myself, how can a person just as Trump, for example, with kids, with grandkids, behave like this? Because he behaves against a world worth living in for the next generation. But looking into this, you see that manipulation and power and all of this is getting a kind of instruments which you like to use when you've reached a special state of arrogance and of not seeing your ground and getting access to your ground and the brain, because of dopamine and because of testosterone, because of these hormones which are flooding you, because you feel so powerful. It is like a monster is taking over. And what you said, Alia, it is so, so, so important. I wished that your message can flow to the world. with people understanding that they should get out of this manipulation, that they get back to their body, their belly brain, understanding that this intuition is more than just like showing you that you are hungry.
Absolutely, I totally agree with you. And that's what I said. People should have their own opinion based on their own research. And now having this, you know, so many tools we can use like ChatGPT AI, you can simply check everything yourself, make your own decision, make your own opinion about everything and everyone, make your own due diligence, right? And then decide what do you want to do, but not to be pushed by someone to make certain decisions or like going to the war, even without understanding why I'm doing this, why I'm killing someone else. I was in the war. I understand how does it work. So it's a strategy for every single person, every single family. In the end of the day, we need to also understand how to help each other and how to save our planets, not how to, you know, kill each other and terminate our planet. And we need to give a good, right example to our new generation, because that's what they see, they learn, they will go and they will implement in the adult life.
Excellent, absolutely. Aliyah, you're a role model to so many, and you went through so much. Is there one small hack you would like to give people below not get manipulated, which keeps you strong every day?
I do a lot of techniques. There's so many, but what keeps me connected and grounded is number one, you should connect with your body. And if you have anxiety or if you're stressed, do 333 techniques. It's actually really powerful and a lot of psychotherapists use it. It's like when you feel anxiety, stop yourself. It's actually like really great when you, Annabelle said that you were away for 4 days alone and being connected to the universe and nature. So simply do the same. If you feel anxiety, sit down, feel the support of the chair or wherever you are sitting. Stop spinning your brain. Concentrate on three things you see. For example, I see you, I see camera, I see my laptop. Three things you hear. For example, I hear like car driving outside. I hear bird singing. I hear my voice. And three things you touch. I touch my hair. I feel the structure. I touch fabric. I touch my skin. So you ground yourself. And this is really powerful. If you do it every day, you will train and program your brain to be connected with your body. And this is the most important. When we connect it to our body, it's really hard someone to actually come and disbalance us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Aliyah. I wish we have more time. I will wish to welcome you here again. I wish to see you very soon and make the world a better place together.
Yes. Together. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And this closes now also our show of We Empower, the radio show to increase and to help people to find their inner self. And I hope you have taken a lot for yourself this week. And join us again next week as we continue on this empowering journey, sharing real stories of triumph, upliftment, and empowerment. Your presence and engagement mean the world to us. And we appreciate you taking the time to tune in. Remember, this time is a gift for you to discover new inspiration, embrace exciting insights, and find the motivation to live life to the fullest, back to your body and your soul. Don't hesitate to get involved. Thank you for being part of our community. And until next time, keep shining and empowering others. Together we rise. Thank you.